Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, Nature Now is here with host Mary Robson and engineer Nora Petridge. This week brings us to the very welcome spring equinox, arriving on Saturday, March 20th. This is the time when the tilt of the Earth in this hemisphere allows approximately the same day and night length. It occurs around 2:30 a.m., and the joy of this equinox comes as we know we will continue to gather longer light in our world, a precious few minutes that will add up to our cherished long summer evenings. This week, we will add about 3 minutes, 30 seconds of light every day. And if you want to know that number regularly, check Weather Underground. They are so thorough, and they will post the number of added minutes as each spring day progresses. Weather Underground is a great resource. So here's an observation, and this will follow an announcement I made in February, as a matter of fact, on February 15th, about the project called Swan Safe. This is for trumpeter swans. The winter life of trumpeter swans in Western Washington is ending. They depart, heading north in March and April, and we don't get to see them again until fall, late fall. Well, when the trumpeter swans migrate back to squim in the fall, their pond takeoffs will be safer because of Project Swan Safe. They used GoFundMe and they raised enough money to pay for a summer project to bury power lines on Kerner Road. The swans have been killed by power line collisions when flying out of Kerner Pond. A group of partners, including Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society, the Clallam County PUD, and the Northwest Swan Conservation Association, contributed to this. The swans will find a different configuration when they return in the fall. Well, now for a mystery sound. This is a bird we are generally glad to see, and I have recently seen one and enjoyed it. So perhaps when you listen to the sounds, you'll at least know which type of bird it is. Today, we are fortunate to have Ann Soule with us again. She's resource manager for the city of Squim and a hydrologist, and she will share the prospects for our seasonal water supply as summer approaches. And it seems to me that a lot of us tend to just look at the short term. If it's raining, we just figure, okay, there's plenty of that. So today I'd like to talk with you about getting past the short term and looking at the water year and how it flows, so to speak. So welcome. Glad to have you back again.
Thanks, Mary. Good to be back. That was a good one, how the water year flows. That just came right out, didn't it?
It really did. I couldn't help myself.
So, well, I mean, this is sort of a funny time. We are having such a wintry March, which is what March does, at least for a part of the time, you know, every year. But here we happen to be looking at a really good snowpack. And so it's a little bit more like winter than spring right now, which is good for us in the long term. You are right. We tend to think, oh, it's been so nice, you know, is that a concern or, oh gosh.
Yeah. And we're talking about the water year, which starts what, October 1st is when you start the measurement for that.
That's right. The way the water year works in the our part of the world, at least, is we get our water in the winter, and that has to last us all year. So because we have dry summers in the West, we don't have rainstorms in the summer normally here. So we have to rely on the snow that comes in the winter and creates our reservoirs in the mountains that hopefully are going to last us till in terms of stream flow melting out through August. So yes, it starts officially, it starts on October 1st and it goes through September 30th.
Okay. So at this point, you had said that we have an unusual or different snowpack than sometimes. Where has it been measured and how much is there and how does it compare with normal or whatever normal is?
All right. Well, I can answer that in a few ways. First, I guess we'll start with today. We have what's called the snow water equivalent, which is how much water is represented by the snowpack rather than, you know, the depth of snow, which can either be really dense and not so deep or really light and fluffy and very deep and still represent the same amount of water. So in terms of water, there's 12.5 inches at the Dungeness Snowtell Station. And for the Dungeness watershed, which is where I work and I live, we are talking about the Dungeness watershed. All of our water in our watershed comes from the peaks south of us. And Gray Wolf tributary is the biggest tributary. And then the Dungeness main stem, you know, all that water comes down, it recharges our aquifer, it keeps the stream flowing in the summer with snowmelt. And yeah, so 12.5 inches for March, mid-March is a lot. And the Snowtell Dungeness is only 4,000 feet elevation, which is much lower in elevation than most of the other stations, which means to have that much more than normal is, it's just an indication of how low the snowpack is this year and unusual that is.
Okay.
The rest of the Olympic Mountains are at, if you combine all the stations, there's about four or five of them. It's showing about 146% of normal. Cascades are somewhere less than that, actually, more like 120 to 140% of their normal.
That is still extremely high, considering how it usually is. If we were looking at a chart that said, okay, for 30 years, the normal for this date is around how much snow water equivalent, roughly. So,
right. So
how does this compare?
Yeah, it's for our station, the Dungeness, it's about, you can see that 12 and a half is even more than the other stations in the Dungeness or in the Olympics. That normal number is very interesting because it comes from, it's a standard statistic that's used in climate, both for snowpack and rainfall and temperature and probably other things, but it's a 30-year normal and they call it the 30-year normal means the 30 years for three decades prior to the date you're talking about. So right now, up until last year, they've been using the 30-year normal would be 1981, the averages for 1981 to 2010. So that 30-year period, all the average of all those parameters for a single date would be the 30-year normal for that date.
So we're using normal as a descriptor for something that is actually data.
Right.
Call it normal, right?
It's an international term. It's used all over. You're right. It's called normal if that's what it was for the 30-year period, as I described, three decades in a row.
Okay, so we're now heading into a recalculation of that because there's another decade that has happened. So there would be a new climate normal coming along. How does that work?
Exactly. Because we just ended a complete decade with 2020, there's going to be a new normal, which will be the three decades prior to now, which is 1991 through 2020. And it's kind of funny just because we're all experiencing a new normal in a lot of ways.
We've used that phrase a lot. It's interesting to see it have a kind of scientific chunk to itself that people are used to saying, okay, this is the normal as far as water equivalents are concerned. So we don't know what the human new normal may be, but at least there's a place to measure it in terms of water. Is it too soon to know what the summer might bring? Are we rushing the game here?
Well, I would have said yes, because, yes, we are moving into spring on Saturday, but technically, in terms of water management, the end of winter is basically April 1st. The climatologists, the meteorologists look at how much snow do we have on April 1st, and then they start doing predictions for the summer, because they can tell from statistics, how has the summer proceeded based on how much snow was there on April 1st.
Uh-huh.
So it's a little bit premature, but I checked and it's looking like we're going to have a very cool spring. It's not like we're heading into some heat waves here in the next week or even few months.
So and with that has an effect on the snowpack, a direct effect?
Exactly. You need to keep the weather cool up in the mountains, or you're going to melt out that snow that is your reservoir for July and August. So, yeah.
Some years that has happened, that it has melted out early.
That has happened, yeah. We've had the full range. I mean, we've had good stream flow in August, and we've had zero stream flow in August. You can't always rely on the rain to keep your rivers flowing in August and September around here. If we have a bad snowpack like we had, well, 2015 was the extreme when we literally had no snowpack left on April 1st.
I have seen pictures of Hurricane Ridge that year, and even in February, it was looking bare.
Yeah,
compared to how it usually looks. So we're not there this year. And as the summer progresses, we'll know a little bit more. But I was wondering if the temperatures are changing, or does any of this data reflect climate change in any way? We don't usually talk about it, but I was just wondering, how do you use the data to look at what is changing in climate?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the long-term trends are what you have to look at with climate.
Okay.
And I think that actually that 30-year normal shift is going to be an easy way to see, well, how has the 30-year normal changed over the past 50 to 100 years?
Uh-huh.
I noticed that somebody in North Carolina has actually already done that with their new normal versus their previous normals. And they saw that their temperatures and their precipitation numbers have both gone up in all the cities around North Carolina.
Aha.
I haven't found that for our state yet.
Okay, I was going to ask, that hasn't been done locally, but certainly it's something that is going to appear and give us data that we need for our thinking. Can we at this point talk a little bit about the difference between weather and climate? Because we are so sensitive to weather, but we don't necessarily think in terms of what that adds to climate. These two things are very different.
Mm. Yeah. And, people who forecast weather, meteorologists have a whole lot of data and a whole lot of statistics that go into their predictions. Forecasting the long-term climate is yet an entirely different academic subject. They look at such long-term numbers, and they try and project rises in CO2 levels and how is that going to affect the ocean temperature, and the ocean temperature decides whether we're going to have an El Nino or a La Nina, and is it, are we going to have bigger storms, and how does it all impact the weather? But really the weather is a small piece of the overall climate picture. It's hard to, I wish kids would learn in school to think in the long term more. As a geologist, I was trained, and so it comes more easily to me. But it's hard. It's hard for people to remember that you got to be thinking about the big picture in the long term, not just what the weather's doing right now.
I have noticed, because I am doing some family letter studies from family members back over about 100 years, almost all of them start by discussing the weather. It's like, hello, I'm writing you on a rainy day.
Yes.
And boy, has it been rainy. And there's something about the effect of weather on the way people see what's around them. Even when we've gotten around to what could be called quite modern times, where we have ways of changing the weather in a house, but that still leaves us with this big climate question. This one, I'm not sure how, if you want to tackle it. If you were going to add climate discussions or long-term, helping children learn to think long-term, what age group would you think you would want to start with?
You know, it seems to me like grade school, upper grade school, and then middle school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I know there's an effort to teach climate in classrooms around the country. In fact, April 7th, I think, is sort of a push to do that. Every teacher everywhere, you know, try and teach something about climate in the class, which are whatever class you're talking about, whether it's economics or science or math or art, you know, any
biology. Yeah. I was curious because I know that part of this pandemic new normal has really presented tremendous challenges to teachers. And I guess what I was thinking about was, if it were possible to isolate an area where there's, the more information you have, the better off you are. From my point of view, it would be climate. So I'm not sure how that's going to affect what teachers are able to communicate. But when we're sitting here on the Olympic Peninsula, looking at the mountains and looking at the snow and thinking, let's see, should I take out my lawn and put in lavender this year? How is that going to go? So those are the kinds of short-term decisions that people tend to make in terms of weather, without thinking about climate. So I thought maybe, since we're gathering ourselves toward the end of talking, maybe you could, for a little bit, explain something we talked about before, which is, where are the, you said there's four or five different ways of measuring snowpack. Where are they? And do they automatically report? Somebody doesn't have to clump up there and look at them, right?
Oh, boy. Actually, they do.
Really?
A few stations that are all completely, you know, telemetry, and it's satellites, the data comes and goes. But there's a couple stations that are still monitored by backcountry skiers. Yeah. And I have who does that. He works for the Olympic National Park, and many of the stations in the Olympics are within the national park. And so it's their staff that actually goes out and downloads the data.
Wow.
You know, calibrates and does some extra measurements and stuff like that. They always need some maintenance. And of course, there's a lot of people that really enjoy that kind of work, being told you have to ski out in the steep mountains to take care of a snow station.
Uh-huh. But it's actually something that is still done hands-on. That's really what I was thinking about. There's a human involved,
yep.
Which is, I think, a way of helping us know, when we think about the water supply here, how many people are involved in checking, testing, retesting, looking, communicating.
Right.
This is not a small effort.
Oh, no. I mean, the farmers are looking at that snowpack all spring, hoping to predict whether they're going to have trouble, or, you know, deciding what to plant and when to plant. Uh-huh. And the people interested in fish, whether they're fishing or they're biologists, just concerned about the status of fish populations. Everybody's watching that water real closely. Uh-huh. I know for me, it's hard to relax if there's not much snow up there this time of year, but we're lucky.
It's good to have something to relax about at this point. So at least for the temporary, what I will suggest is, we discussed getting back together toward the middle of summer and looking at the situation as it develops. I'm very much looking forward to doing that. We will see. At that point, we're going to be looking at stored water rather than anything that's likely to fall through precipitation, right?
That's right.
It's hard for people to realize that the Emerald World stays that way on its own up until about May 1st, and then there is no more emerald falling unless we're very fortunate. So I so appreciate your being here. I always feel like I've got a little more sense of where things are going. In the meantime, we can make the point that saving water, it's not a wasted thing to think about saving water. Even now.
It's not a waste to conserve water. No,
it's real important. Thank you so much. I have really appreciated
it. You're welcome.
So, okay.
Bye-bye.
We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. The mystery sound is the downy woodpecker. This lives locally year-round. They resemble hairy woodpeckers in color, but they're very much smaller. The hairy woodpecker is a bit almost the size of a robin, and the downy woodpecker is just about 6 inches, including the tail, slightly bigger than chickadees. The males of the downy woodpecker have very distinctive red feathers on the top of their head. And you can notice this best if you're able to watch the woodpecker perching. They have such beautiful black and white designs. The downy woodpeckers typically inhabit broadleafed and mixed forests, especially those with black cottonwood and willow. One survival advantage they have is they can live in second and third growth forest, and they can live with garden ornamentals. They do not depend on an old growth forest or on very large trees, as some of our birds do. Downy woodpeckers eat mainly insects, including beetle larvae that live inside wood or tree bark. That's part of what causes them to do drumming. And they also eat ants and caterpillars. They will collect and eat pests, including tent caterpillars, bark beetles, and apple borers. This is a very helpful woodpecker. About a quarter of their diet consists of plant material, particularly berries, acorns, and grains. And I think you have to be pretty determined to get anything out of an acorn, but they do. Downy woodpeckers are common feeder birds. They eat suet and black oil sunflower seeds, and occasionally they drink from hummingbird feeders. And this is one of the things that you can use to help identify them, because they have a small beak that is finer in size than most woodpeckers, which allows them to access a hummingbird feeder. And that is a downy woodpecker. They are common and widespread throughout their range, and they seem nicely adapted to human-inhabited areas, which, of course, is where all of us are, in human-inhabited areas. To enjoy podcasts of past programs, there are hundreds. Come to kptz.org and follow the podcast section. Appreciation to Nora Petrich for keeping us on the air even when we cannot be in the studio. Thanks for sharing Nature Now with us today. Today's song is Cool Water by the Sons of the Pioneers, which many of us absolutely enjoy and sing along with.
Oh, Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water.
Water.
Cool. Keep on moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man, and he spread the burning sand with water.
Water.
Then can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? The nights are cool and I'm a pool, each star's a pool of water, cool water. But with the dawn I'll wake and yawn and carry on to water, cool, clear water. Keep a moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man, and he spread the burning sand with water. Then can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we pray for water, cool water. And way up there he'll hear our prayer and show us where there's water. Moving down, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man, and he spread the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? Dan's feet are sore, he's yearning for just one thing more than water, cool water. Like me,